From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. No prison in history has ever had the fascination of that island in the San Francisco Bay, Alcatraz. It's been the subject of many books and films. David Ward is my guest this week, and his latest book is Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. It's a definitive history of that prison and its prisoners. David Ward, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
Why are we so fascinated with this prison in particular?
Well, it's really an iconic prison. It has been the best-known penitentiary in the world ever since it opened in the summer of 1934. It was the product of the era of the public enemies and the federal government trying to control the gangsters that were kidnapping businessmen and holding them for ransom, and all those stories that we've seen involving Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger and Babyface Nelson and the Barker Karpus mob and the rest have become part of American folklore. And when you have a prison that is within sight of hundreds of thousands of people living in San Francisco Bay, but they can't get there, and the press is barred for 30 years from ever interviewing an inmate or visiting the island to do a story, and you have Al Capone there and Machine Gun Kelly and later on the Birdman, it creates a very high profile and lots of press and public interest. Alcatraz closed in March of 1963, but when the Park Service turned it over, turned it into a tourist attraction 10 years later, it became an attraction for visitors to San Francisco, and now has over a million people a year visiting the island, so its image and reputation has been kept alive, in part by the unique feature that for most people who have done time in a high-security penitentiary, they're really not proud of having been in prison and want everyone to know about their stories. But the Alcatraz convicts, and they call themselves convicts, are really proud of having done time on the rock, and consequently many of them have written their stories or told their stories, and visitors to the island for the last decades have in many cases been able to talk to a genuine inmate or a former prison guard. Alcatraz, even now, is famous. For example, a couple of weeks ago, three Republican members of Congress and one U.S. senator proposed solving the problem of what to do with high-value detainees from Guantanamo by putting them in Alcatraz, simply because that is the best-known prison in the world, and I guess I should add also because it is at Speaker Pelosi's congressional district.
Of course, it would cost California millions in revenue if they stopped. It stopped being a museum, yeah?
Well, that's right. Of course, it is completely antiquated, and that's impossible. It's just invoking the name. And last week, when the torture hearings were going on in before a Senate subcommittee, one of the people who testified talked about how Barack Obama has taken the high moral road by closing Guantanamo, just as Attorney Robert Kennedy took the high road in 1962 by ordering the closure of Alcatraz. So it's still with us, and the two prisons, the two federal prisons that have taken Alcatraz's role as the penitentiary of last resort for federal prisoners, the one in Marion, Illinois, was always called the New Alcatraz, and its successor at Florence, Colorado, is called Alcatraz of the Rockies. The reason for that, I think, is pretty clear, and that is that the federal government doesn't want a soft-sounding prison with a feminine name like Marion or Florence. They want a name that's got some Z's in it.
Alcatraz.
Alcatraz.
Well, how many living convicts are there who serve time? And do you know the answer to that?
I don't know the answer to that because, of course, they have been spread across the country. I will say that for this project, one of the really special features is that early on, when we found by looking at post-release arrest records, that half of the entire population and 63% of the inmates who were at Alcatraz when it was at its toughest during the gangster era, 63% never returned to prison after release. This was a rather unexpected outcome, given that they were all classified as habitual and incorrigible, and we were able to locate 100 former prisoners and guards for interview, because when the statistics come up with the findings that nobody expected, you need to talk to the people who lived the experience to try to explain how these prisoners were able to overcome the incredible odds that they had facing them to come back to the free world and to stay there.
Well, David Ward, are you saying, correct me if you're not saying this, but are you saying that Alcatraz worked? That is, it was horrible, but once you were in prison there, you never wanted to be in prison again?
Well, I would say that early in this project, a noted California criminologist, John Irwin, when I was describing the outcome that these inmates were succeeding beyond expectations, he asked me, he said, is this the project that proves that punishment works? I think the answer to that is no, it's really the aging process that works. The inmates who came out of Alcatraz and went to other prisons and were finally returned to the free world were in their early 40s. They'd done an awful lot of time. They'd had years of solitary reflection on the island because there were no programs at Alcatraz, absolutely nothing. Everybody was locked up at 4:45 for the evening and didn't come out until the call for breakfast the next morning. Plenty of time to think and read. Inmates at Alcatraz averaged reading 90 books a year, and they thought about what had happened to them. They thought about all the bank robberies they'd committed, and they divided it up by the number of years that they were serving time. The rate wasn't very good. Their wives are living with someone else. Their kids are being raised by someone else. Mother died a year ago, and they couldn't go to the funeral. And they find the most difficult thing about prison life is getting along with their fellow prisoners, even though in the Alcatraz era, the convict code prevailed, which gave them a sense of solidarity and support for each other. During all of these years on that rocky island with really boredom as the main program, they thought a lot about their past and made conscious decisions not to come back to prison while they still had some time left to live in the free world. These are rational choice prisoners. And I do want to add that what I'm saying here should not be generalized to any standard prison population, state or federal, but the Alcatraz era convicts, very few of them had alcohol or drug dependency problems. Also, they were federal offenders, and only a handful were sex offenders. So when they came out, they were not subjected to the special scrutiny that a sex offender would get in California. And they did not have alcohol and drug problems to overcome. The stories that we were able to put in this book, by virtue of being able to locate the successes, really are incredible stories of perseverance and overcoming the odds. When people came out of prison in their 40s, most of them had no families. Parents had gone. Once in a while, someone had a brother or a sister who would help out. They had no wives or children. They had to make it completely on their own, but they followed the rule that you should never have any association with your fellow convicts, knowing that that can so easily lead back to trouble. And this book documents the incredible perseverance and determination to make it in the free world and not spend any more time locked up on a rocky island with absolutely nothing to do.
We're talking with David Ward, and he's the author of the book Alcatraz, The Gangster Years. How did Alcatraz come to be? I mean, in your book you mentioned that it was a prison. They had put conscientious objectors from World War I there. They put Indians there. But how did it become the federal prison?
Well, it was a military prison in the 1930s, and the military really was running out of a reason to keep it. And when the Attorney General of the United States, Homer Cummings, under orders from the President, was told to find a new prison to lock up the worst of the worst federal offenders, these high-profile gangsters, that is, those that survive shootouts with the FBI and local police, the island was simply available, and the Bureau of Prisons, which did not want it, was ordered to take it over and to modify it to take on this population of high-profile prisoners. It really is only in the first 5 years of Alcatraz existence, from 34 to 39, that there was a significant population of high-profile offenders whose names would be familiar across the country, 16%. After that short period, there were only about 5% of the Alcatraz inmate populations in later years that were there because they were high-profile federal offenders. They were on the, most of the inmates who went there were sent there because they were the most troublesome, escape-prone, difficult-to-manage prisoners in the federal system. And that has been the same ratio that applied to Marion, Illinois, when it took over Alcatraz's role in 1983, where high-profile offenders like John Gotti and a number of so-called traitors and spies were sent there, and Florence, Colorado, which now has people like Nichols from the Oklahoma City bombing, the Unabomber, the World Trade Center bombers, the abortion bomber, all high-profile, and Massawi and other, quote, terrorists. But it also has the leaders of the major prison gangs and the most violent and dangerous inmates in terms of assaulting other prisoners and staff. The primary role of Alcatraz and its two successors has been to offer up a symbol of harsh punishment for a handful of high-profile offenders while using the prisons to deal with the federal prison system's most difficult management problems.
What is the maximum amount of prisoners that ever were incarcerated at Alcatraz?
1,500, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
The population was usually about 250 or 60 at any given time, and people went and stayed there for quite a long time. It was only open for 30 years.
Was anybody there the entire 30?
No. The longest serving convict was a gangster named Alvin Karpus, who was there for 25 years, although that 25 years was broken up by an effort to try him out at Leavenworth, but that didn't work, and he was sent back to Alcatraz.
Did he die there, or he was eventually
No, he was eventually paroled and lived to be deported to Canada, wrote a book about his experiences and why it was untrue that J. Edgar Hoover had personally arrested him in a very high-profile case back in the 1930s,
mm-hmm.
and moved to Spain and died in Spain.
Now, what about Al Capone? I guess he's probably, along with Robert Stroud, the most famous Alcatraz inmate.
Well, Al Capone, of course, was the great symbolic commitment to Alcatraz. If there was ever anyone who was seen as above the law and beyond the control of federal authorities, it was Capone. While he was only doing a 10-year sentence for income tax evasion, that sentence began with his commitment to the federal penitentiary at Atlanta, Georgia. But at Atlanta, he was such a celebrity that it created image problems. For example, there were reports that he had special living conditions and was able to have special food that the other inmates weren't having. An associate director of the Bureau of Prisons was sent to Atlanta to make a surprise visit. I interviewed him for this project. He went into the penitentiary at noontime and told the warden that he wanted to be taken immediately to Capone's cell, where he found Big Al in a cell with seven cronies feasting on a number of southern fried chickens and homemade pies that had been sent into them from outside the prison. Well, with stories like that and effort that the staff members were as impressed with Big Al as were his fellow convicts, Alcatraz was seen as the place where that kind of outside influence would no longer prevail and he would become just number 85 along with the other prisoners. At Alcatraz, however, Capone began to show the effects of syphilis, and his mental health deteriorated, which posed a problem for the Bureau of Prisons, which was always being accused of having a regime that was driving men to madness. There were books written such as Helcatraz, The Rock of Despair, The Tomb of the Living Dead, America's Devil's Island, all claiming that the regime was so harsh that no prisoner, even the desperados who were there, could stand up to the regime. When you have the highest profile prisoner manifesting legitimate problems of mental health, it would seem to the Bureau of Prisons that that might prove the point of the critics. So Capone was transferred from Alcatraz to Terminal Island Prison in Southern California and ultimately released from a penitentiary on the East Coast and to his home in Palm Island, Florida, where he died several years later. But his mental health had been negatively affected, and he was never the man when he came out that he was when he went in.
He did die a free man, though.
Yes, he did.
That's very interesting for this most famous gangster, I guess, of all time. But let me ask you about Robert Stroud, the famous Birdman of Alcatraz. There's not a lot about Robert Stroud in your book, but I was surprised to read that really it was the fact that he had written a book about birds and was an expert on birds that really got him sent to Alcatraz.
Well, that is the second volume of the Alcatraz saga, which we'll have out in the next couple of years. But Robert Stroud did come to Alcatraz during the era that is described in this book. He was sent to Alcatraz after he murdered a guard by stabbing him to death in the dining room at Leavenworth. There is no more significant prison misconduct than killing an officer in the dining room where there were hundreds and hundreds of other prisoners. However, when this event occurred, they remained mute.
Was there any justification? I mean, or was there some, maybe not justification is the wrong word, but provocation for him? His murder of his guard?
The provocation was that the officer had told Stroud the previous evening that he was going to write him up for a minor misconduct. Stroud was at Leavenworth because his initial sentence, which was at McNeil Island Penitentiary in the state of Washington, was for trying to kill another prisoner. He never expressed remorse for killing the officer and was sentenced to death by hanging. The gallows were being constructed at Leavenworth when Stroud's mother was able to prevail on President Wilson's wife to commute his sentence to life without parole. The Bureau of Prisons interpreted that to mean life in solitary confinement. And Stroud, for the rest of his career at Leavenworth and for the years he was at Alcatraz, was kept by himself in a single cell. Not solitary confinement, because conversation with other prisoners was as easy as talking out the bars in front of the cell. But while at Leavenworth, as everyone knows from having seen the movie, he developed an expertise in treating canaries and other birds, developed a business, became a celebrity. There was a movement to free the great man from prison, and he became a nuisance and a public relations problem for the Bureau of Prisons. So So, as with other nuisances and other public relations problems, troublemakers, Alcatraz was the right place to keep him and keep him isolated from the free world. So he went to Alcatraz and stayed there until the prison was getting ready to close in the early 1960s, when he went to the Springfield Medical Center, where for the first time, he had no birds, of course, at Alcatraz. At Springfield, he had some association with other prisoners and died the day before President Kennedy was shot.
Wow, that's interesting. I wanted to ask you about the guards at Alcatraz. What was it like to be a guard there?
Well, that's an interesting part of the story, because there was so much corruption and influence peddling in federal prisons of the time. The judgment about the efficacy of Alcatraz Island was that you could get the staff to live on it, on the island, and you would have great control over the employees. That was very specifically intended. All of the key personnel were required to live on the island, and they developed their own kind of social life there. Most of them who have for the last several decades been coming back to the island to talk about their careers on the Rock are quite proud of them, even though during the entire 3 decades which Alcatraz was a federal penitentiary, they were instructed never to talk to anyone in the free world about their experiences on the island. That was strictly forbidden. And when my first visit to Alcatraz, which was in June of 1962 to start this project, I was told that I was the first person, non-criminal justice person, who had been allowed to go to the island and had been told that I could have access to records, prisoners, and personnel. Actually, the prison closed 9 months after my visit there and was put on the back burner until the Park Service made Alcatraz a tourist attraction, at which point the Bureau of Prisons asked me if I would like to start up the project and promised to help me find prisoners and make the records available. And in the course of the project, interview more than 40 officers, lieutenants, and captains and wardens who were at the island from 1934 to 1963. Their stories are very much like the prisoners. Everyone was having frequent conversations with Al Capone and the Birdman. They all remember the great escapes. And for a prison where the life was primarily pretty boring and monotonous and monastic most of the time, I think it's not surprising that both the prisoners and the guards would focus on the personalities that everybody loves to hear about and the great escapes that have been featured in more than 14 different movies about Alcatraz.
Was there ever a successful escape from Alcatraz?
Well, I feel that there was. In December of 1962, an inmate by the name of John Paul Scott was able to sever the bars in the in a work area below the kitchen, and he and another inmate were able to get out of the cell house itself, that is, this basement window of the cell house, climb up a drain pipe, and they took with them the cord from a heavy industrial floor polisher. They used that to climb down on the other side of the prison, on the Golden Gate Bridge side, entered the water. One of the inmates was a last-minute addition to the escape attempt, and he did not make it more than a few feet offshore because it turned out that he had never learned to swim but had told his fellow escapee that he had read a book about swimming. He didn't make it, but
it's easy to learn to swim by just reading about it.
It's pretty cold in there. John Paul Scott, however, had taken the trouble to get a number of surgical gloves, which he was able to glue together and use a straw to blow them up so that they provided the flotation assistance. And he left the island, floated with the current along past Ghirardelli Square, and made it over to the basis of Fort Point, which is right under the southern end of the Golden Gate Bridge. But as he tried to come out of the water, he encountered barnacle-covered rocks which were very, very painful, and he began to suffer from hypothermia. Fortunately for him, a couple on the bridge above saw him, notified bridge authorities, and he was rescued and taken to Letterman Hospital and treated for hypothermia, with all parties assuming that he was there because he had tried to jump, that he had jumped from the bridge.
Uh-huh.
The next day, the staff at Alcatraz sent a junior officer over to Letterman Hospital to check out the guy who jumped from the bridge, and there was their prisoner. What that showed was that he came very close to making it successfully to land, and he had been told that right on the other side of the Golden Gate Bridge there was a sandy beach. But when I interviewed him numerous times, he said that he was afraid that that was just convict talk, and with the speed that the water was going out the Golden Gate, he was afraid the next stop would be Honolulu. So he didn't try to make it. Well, I went to that spot, and right around the corner from where he was pulled out of the water on the rocks, there is a beautiful sandy beach. And in the interview that I did with Scott, he is seen, you hear him looking at the photos that I took and exclaiming, oh my God, I almost made it. And you hear me apologizing for showing the pictures to him. I shouldn't have spoiled his image of the escape when it was so very, very close for him to have been the first and only successful escapee from Alcatraz.
Was he taken back to Alcatraz?
Yes, he was taken back to Alcatraz and ended up doing many more years of time in federal prisons. He was the kind of prototypical Alcatraz convict who, if you said, my gosh, I see you're doing 40 years here for bank robbery, he would say, well, I'm really not too concerned because I don't expect to be here that long. He had escape in his bones, and after Alcatraz, he made four very, very stunning escape attempts from other federal prisons.
Amazing.
He is amazing. He's an amazing character.
And I guess you've met quite a few. It's an amazing book. It's not a little book, ladies and gentlemen. It's about 600 pages or so.
Well, actually, the printed version is about 550.
Yeah.
If you're looking at a page-proof version, but it is a big book. But this is a big story, and I felt that it was important for people to be able to read in the words of the prisoners themselves what it was like to do time on the rock, and also what happened to them when they finally came back to the free world, which I think is just as interesting and important a story. Now, this is backed up by a lot of factual information because we had the records available, and that produced not only the surprising findings about post-release success, but evidence that the inmates were not driven mad on the island. Only 8% of the entire Alcatraz population was transferred from the prison for being diagnosed with legitimate mental health problems, and we found that a number of them clearly had brought those problems with them to the island. This does not mean that people were not affected by the experience of Alcatraz, that their personalities and their recollections for the rest of their lives always revolved around those years on the rock. But in terms of mental health problems that called for psychiatric treatment and mental hospital confinement, it was a very small group of people. How they did their time, I think, is one of the important stories. And if I could just mention one other thing,
mm-hmm.
We looked at the misconduct records of the prisoners and found, again, to everyone's surprise, including all the convicts and prison employees that I interviewed, that those prisoners who had the worst misconduct records were much more likely to succeed after release than the so-called model prisoners. That is, this goes against the credo of every parole board, which is to keep you in prison longer if you're raising hell. And yet, when I interviewed the prisoners and the guards, it seemed to make sense to them, because their view was that no person could, as the criminologist John Irwin calls it, no prisoner can maintain his integrity doing hard time without resisting the regime. You can't allow yourself to be given that complete childlike status. The inmates at Alcatraz did rebel, and those who rebelled were proud of what they did. Now, this is the kind of rebellion that we don't see in today's prisons, which have become much more violent. This is not trying to kill officers. This is rebellion by every means possible to combat the regime, to get contraband, disobeying orders, insolence, and what have you, but not going for the throats of employees. These prisoners who accumulated these records, some of them years and years and years in disciplinary segregation and solitary confinement cells, felt when they came out of prison that they had stood up for themselves. This is what psychologists call locus of control theory. It's been seen also among military prisoners. They were proud of having stood up against the regime, and to be honest, a good many of the officers that we interviewed said the same thing, that if they had been prisoners there with a regime that controlled the minutiae of daily life, every single aspect of human living, that they would have rebelled. They would have accumulated prison misconduct reports, too. So it's to maintain your self-concept, to feel that you haven't given in, is a way to prepare you for dealing with the outside world when you come out, where there isn't going to be a regime or personnel who will tell you what to do every day. You are completely on your own. The model prisoners had accepted that childlike status that goes with completely going along with the program in prison, and seemed to be less able to make it on their own when they will finally return to the free world.
Well, it's some fascinating stuff, David Warden. We're going to look forward to Volume 2 in a couple of years. What's Volume 2 called?
It doesn't have a name yet, but it completes the history of Alcatraz and then goes on to follow the Alcatraz inmates who ended up in its successor institution, and why they felt that the end of the convict code was something that was very destructive to the convicts themselves, that the convict code said your job is to not make trouble for your fellow prisoners, your job is to make trouble for the staff. But at Marion, Illinois, when the Alcatraz regime was imposed, 25 inmates had killed other inmates, and there was a war going on between racial and ethnic groups and drug gangs that made living in prison much more dangerous as created by other prisoners than any regime that the staff had ever created.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk about that when your next volume comes out. David Ward, thanks so much for being with us on From the Bookshelf.
Well, thank you for asking me.
That closes the book on this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening. I'll be back again next week with another wonderful program. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her assistance. Thanks, Breanne. I'll see you next time. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Good night.